My next guest, the Australian-American award-winning author and journalist Geraldine Brooks, grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney in the 60s and 70s, worked for 3 years as a feature writer with the Sydney Morning Herald, focusing on environmental issues, and then went on to become a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She and her late wonderful husband, Tony Horowitz, were a double act from the start and won an Overseas Press Club Award for their coverage of the Gulf War. After turning to historical fiction, she won the Pulitzer way back in 2006 for her novel March, which was based on the father of the girls featured in Louisa May Alcott's book Little Women. Since then, four other best-selling novels, the most recent being The Secret Chord, about the life of King David. More about that a little later. But the most prescient of her books was has to be The Year of Wonders, written in 2001, based on the sacrifices made by the villagers of Eme in rural England in 1666. They quarantined themselves voluntarily as the bubonic plague reached their remote part of the world. Geraldine, it's wonderful to have you back. And let me remind you that the last time we actually spoke was a few days after 9/11, when, as you'll recall, George Bush couldn't name any world leaders but was ready to press the button.
That's right. And 20 years later, the troops are still engaged. But fortunately, Biden says he'll be bringing the war in Afghanistan to an end, from the American perspective, at least.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Joe later, but I remember you said that America's outward focus during the Cold War was actually an anomaly, just like the War on Terror, and that it was much more comfortable with isolationism. We've seen that again, haven't we not?
I think it's a terribly introspective culture, Philip, really. Having lived here for so long now, I really feel the contrast that Aussies look outward to the world and Americans look inward. It's a big generalization, but I think it's true. I think most people are very uninvolved in foreign policy. And I think the burdens of Americans' foreign policy decisions fall disproportionately on the least equipped to know what they're getting into, which tends to be the poor and underprivileged communities here who actually have to go and fight the wars.
What's fascinating about the villagers of Eme was that they were probably persuaded to quarantine by the pastor for religious salvation. We don't really know, though, do we?
Well, you know, there's a lot that we don't know about what exactly happened in Eme, but it does seem pretty clear-cut that it was the young minister and then his older, the man he'd succeeded, because, of course, it was a time of great religious dispute in England, and it was the return of the Orthodox Church after the rather short-lived Puritan experiment. So there'd been an old minister who'd been of a Puritan disposition, and he'd been displaced by this young whippersnapper. But when the crisis of bubonic plague hit the village, the two men bridged their religious divides, and it's pretty clear that they did work together to bring the villagers to this remarkable, I think, unique act of self-sacrifice, which was a voluntary quarantine.
And, of course, you argue that they probably preached on the text, greater love hath no man than this.
Well, that's a total, you know, that's my imagination at work. We don't know what they preached on, but I think if I was preaching it, I'd pick that one. That seemed like a good one to me to go with. But that's where the novelist's imagination has to come into play. You try and think, how would you convince a community to come together on such a momentous decision?
Now, as far as we know, Eme remains the only time in history quarantine was voluntary. At the same time, of course, in London, Samuel Pepys describes the complete opposite. People being locked up in their houses, the sick with the well, nobody to bring food or water.
That's right, while the rich fled, including the church leaders, very conspicuously. Anyone who had the means got out of town because it was such a death trap. And Pepys writes, "We have become cruel as dogs one to another."
How many, well, what's the percentage of people who died in Aim, do we know?
We think about two-thirds of the village at the end of the day succumbed to the plague, which is a terrible price.
Well, like most crises, the best and worst comes out, and scapegoats were also to be found in Aim. I understand that revenge was taken out on healers, on witches, mostly women.
Well, again, that's the novelist's speculation, because we have very few written records from the years of plague itself. There's a lot of oral tradition that grew up later, but really the only documents we have are the last will and testaments and three letters that were written by the vicar, not exactly written, but more or less shouted in dictation across a social distance, as we've come to call it, and the rector in the next parish took down his words. So what I did as a novelist was take my own experience as a reporter covering catastrophes and seeing how people respond in the times of worst crisis. And I gave those kinds of reactions to the people of Aim, because I'd seen people become their best selves, courageous and generous and heroic. And I'd seen them come their worst selves, like morally lost, torturers. So I allowed both possibilities to the people of Aim.
Almost every catastrophe, and we've seen it now, of course, in the pandemic, does two things. It brings communities closer together and tears them apart.
Yes, I think that is true. Although in the case of Aim, they didn't really have the luxury of being too torn apart, because they really were confined almost, I describe it as a wide green prison.
How did your own sort of island of Martha's Vineyard fare during the pandemic?
At first, there was tremendous fear here, because it became clear how grave this was going to be in what's the very dead of our winter, when it really is only the year-round community here. And the year-round community is a rural farming, fishing, construction workers, a few feckless artists like myself. But it's a small town life in the winter. And people here were afraid that we'd be deluged by essentially refugees from the cities, and things were going so badly in New York City. And there was a tremendous sentiment to raise the drawbridges and keep ourselves safe, because we only have a small rural hospital here, and there was fear that that would be overwhelmed. So it was a small segment of the community, but there was tremendous failure of generosity, I think, of spirit towards people who wanted to come and be safe. And it became quite an argument in the community. Why wouldn't you encourage people to come to their summer homes where they're out in the woods and they can keep a social distance much more easily than in an apartment building with a single elevator? So there was a lot of back and forth about that. But we actually, up till now, have done very well on the island. People behaved responsibly, and we haven't had a single death, touch wood, from COVID on the island. We've had a number of cases, but people have recovered, which has been wonderful.
Talking to Geraldine Brooks, Pulitzer Prize winner, ABC Boyer lecturer, former foreign correspondent, and so much more. A new book by American scientist Peter Hotez on preventing the next pandemic points to the fact that alongside war, political instability, human migration, poverty, urbanisation, there are two preventable factors in the next pandemic, being populism and anti-science, including, of course, anti-vaxxers. Do you agree?
Yes, and I think also climate change, our failure to come to terms and do the things that are necessary. Look, Philip, the last time I was home was in the midst of the terrible fires. And I thought the one thing that is going to come out of this horrible time of loss and tragedy is going to be this country will wake up and realize that we have to go another way.
And, of course, that didn't happen at the political level.
I hear that, you know, that we're still logging, you know, precious rare koala habitat. New South Wales government's talking about more coal mines in the Hunter. I ask myself, you know, is this Pharaoh? How many plagues do you need?
The WHO has identified vaccine hesitancy as one of the world's most urgent health issues. And, of course, right-wing groups invoke medical freedom or choice to justify withholding vaccines from kids, and the anti-vaxxers are still on the march.
And, you know, I have to say my friends on the left are not innocent here either. There's a lot of, you know, ridiculous anti-science, let's just strengthen our own immune systems and, you know, Big Pharma is entirely evil and can't be trusted, comes from the left as well. I tell you, on this island, it's the hippie communities, of which I count myself a proud member, have the lowest vaccination rate in the state of Massachusetts. And I find that disgraceful. I've had a lot of arguments about it with people who are my friends. So you can't just lay it on the right wing.
The aforementioned Hotez wrote a book about his daughter. Vaccines did not cause Rachel's autism. And he notes that Amazon is the most active promoter of fake anti-vaccine books. I find that extraordinary.
Yeah, I'd like to know what the stats are that he's using about promotion. Obviously, Bezos is a big libertarian, so he's probably allowing any book to be up there. But whether they're actively promoting it with their algorithm, I'd be interested to learn.
Geraldine, how did you endure the dark age of Trump?
I enjoyed it very poorly. I found it had a huge impact on my writing. I felt that I was a person who could write under almost any circumstances because of my journalistic training, that you have to file, or you know, you can't tell your desk that your muse didn't arrive this morning. However, Trump was the death of my muse. I found that I had no desire to be writing about the injustices of the past when grave injustice was being perpetrated in the present, and I felt that what I was doing was quite irrelevant. So yes, my productivity fell under the Trump regime. So I'm very glad to see the back of the orange menace.
Are you having a new lease of life now in the Biden era?
Biden is so exceeding my expectations. I was obviously for him as the anti-Trump. I had no idea that what appears to be the truth now is that he will be a truly transformative president. He seems to be making just the right moves to heal this country, to take serious steps on climate change, green energy, and also income inequality. So I just hope he's able to keep going. I wish him the best of health.
I must say his first 100 days are damned impressive. And, he's more of a Bernie Sanders than any of us could possibly have anticipated.
Yeah, you know, I think he really understands what it means to be working class and to struggle. And he hasn't forgotten that, and he carries it with him in the way he approaches not just policy, but in communicating that policy. So it's been astonishing and encouraging to watch, because this country is in such a bad way on so many levels. And it really is going to take a tremendous amount of force of personality and ability to turn it around.
Geraldine, we're having this conversation on the very day that the Derek Chauvin verdict could be announced for the death of George Floyd. Demonstrations for days now. The tension is high.
Yes, the tension is high, and I think people are holding their breath. However, the prosecution case was extraordinarily strong and the defense was lackluster. So I am cautiously hopeful that in this case justice will be served.
Well, if it ain't, America will burn again. Now, on Monday, Chris Cuomo, CNN host, said that there's little light in America right now. Everybody's exhausted, frustrated from fear, from COVID, from the riots, mass shootings, police killings, the injustices. Heavens above, America has just had the fifth mass shooting this month.
They never get to raise the flag anymore. It's always at half staff because as soon as it goes up, there's another mass shooting and down it comes again.
How do you feel about America? I mean, you are effectively half American now.
Well, I always was, Philip. My dad came to Australia just before World War II and fell in love with the place. But he had, you know, quite an American personality, even though he embraced his new Aussie life. But yeah, no, I've spent a great deal more time here than I ever expected to, partly because my beloved husband was a more stubborn bastard than I am. But now because my sons have their lives very rooted here and one of them is adopted internationally and it's very, very difficult. Our government is totally weird on the subject of foreign adoption. And so there's no guarantee that if we come back, he'll even get citizenship very easily. So there's a lot at stake there.
One of the mad Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene, had to backtrack after launching America First platform, promoting, as you know, Anglo-Saxon political traditions and nativist ideas like white replacement theory, that's a trope of white supremacists. She's backed down, but of course this sort of viewpoint won't go away.
It will eventually because it's a bunch of, you know, old people watching Fox News they're going, you know, the future is not with them. This country is a multicultural, multicolored, multi-ethnic society, and that is what is going to prevail. And what we're seeing is the scared death throes of a few antediluvian minds here, but they can do a lot of damage on the way down.
Tony began work on his last book, Spying on the South, asking the question whether America was still one nation. I understand that I recall that he got the book title from a girl down south who asked what he was doing there. She said, "You look like you've come down here to spy on us hillbillies."
That's right, you Yankee spy. Yes, indeed. He was an eternal optimist about this country. You know, he loved this country and he hated Donald Trump. And he was one of the people who saw all this coming. When I watched the invasion of the Capitol, I thought, you know, good grief, Tony probably met half those people at some point in his reporting because he was the guy who ran towards the deplorables and he would sit and talk with people that others shunned and didn't listen to. And he knew what was out there in terms of race hate and anti-Semitism, white supremacy. He knew this 20 years ago, but he was always an optimist that the country could be brought together again.
When writing Spying on the South, he didn't want people to see him as a contemptuous coastal elite, but rather, and I quote, as that guy from up north who appeared on the next bar stool one Friday after work and asked about their job and life and hopes for the future and thought what they said was important enough to write down. Well, he certainly achieved that.
He certainly did. Miss him every day.
Tony followed, of course, in the footsteps of America's most accomplished landscaper, Frederick Olmsted. known for, of course, designing Central Park, who journeyed during the 1850s in the lead-up to the Civil War, just as Tony journeyed during the awful changes of the Trump years. Tell me about Tony's interest in Olmsted.
So this all came about, we put in some new bookshelves and I said, it's no good, we'll never keep up with the amount of books that come into this house, but I want you to do a serious cull on your college textbooks because you're never going to pick up, you know, that Derrida deconstructionist whatnot. And so he dutifully got out a cardboard carton and started going through the books, and there were very few going into the giveaway pile, I have to say. That he got stuck when he picked up a book called The Cotton Kingdom, which was Olmsted's account of his southern travels. And instead of a cull, he then sent away for another 100 or so books about by Olmsted. So that didn't work very well. But what he found was a real kindred spirit, because Olmsted, before he found his métier as a landscape designer, was a reporter, essentially, very much like Tony, a very curious, open-hearted young man who traveled and wanted to feel the drift of things, as he called it. And he said, I am born for a traveler. And so, you know, he traveled and talked to everybody just as Tony did. And Tony could feel a great kinship across the years. And Olmsted was working undercover for the very new newspaper at that point, the New York Times, when he made his southern journey. And the idea was to see if this rift over slavery could be healed or not. And he came to the conclusion that it couldn't. And that was what led him to think about how can we bridge divides in this society. And he thought that public parks, which were not really a thing in those days, was a way to bring different classes and kinds of people together in a peaceful exchange. And just by proximity and enjoying nature, that people would be uplifted and see each other in a different light. And that was how New York got the marvelous city-saving, I think, Central Park, without which that would be an unlivable place.
And, of course, Tony did share Olmsted's stated aim for the trip, travelling in, and I quote, a missionary spirit, believing there's always room for dialogue and great value in having it, if only to make it harder for Americans to demonize one another.
Exactly. So that was exactly how he felt, and that was exactly how he lived.
And, of course, Tony observed pretty much the same divisions as Olmsted, but his journey among Hillary's deplorables also revealed a real spirit of generosity and curiosity. That is a surprise.
Well, it shouldn't be really, because I think what happens is, you know, we can demonize each other in the pixelated alternative world of online insult, but we can't really do it face to face. I mean, when you're face to face with somebody, you have to accept their essential humanity. And I think it's our nature to reach out to one another. And so it's just unfortunate that too much dialogue doesn't happen in person anymore.
Geraldine, when Olmsted comes back to work on the Central Park, his encounters with slavery were important. You've already talked briefly to that.
Yeah, indeed. He actually became intensely involved with an effort among some German abolitionists who had settled in Texas. And he was working with them on all kinds of schemes that would turn the tide against slavery in the South. None of them really came to fruition. And then he became completely absorbed in what was to be the real business of his life, which was park making all over this country. And so many cities are better because of his work. Although, you know, after Reconstruction, the mingling that he had imagined turned into segregation again in many places.
Tony's book, Confederates in the Attic, was his attempt to get his head around what he called America's unfinished Civil War. And he managed to engage the only living Confederate widow in talking about the future. And I love this. She said, "If it's like it's usually been, Ben, it won't be so good."
Yeah, he was great at getting people to open up in that way. And he was wonderful at capturing their quirky idioms as well.
So at the moment, do you feel there's cause for optimism? Do you think that Biden can repair some of the profound damage wreaked by Trump?
I do, and I don't think it's just Biden. I think there has been a real awakening about racial injustice in this country, not for the first time, to be sure. I think there was a similar period in the 60s of recognition of the debt owed. And I guess it's always, you know, three steps forward, two steps back in this country, or it seems to be. But I do really feel it. I was just listening to an interview with a woman from rural Idaho, and she talked about watching George Floyd's last breath and how she wept. And she wasn't just weeping for the tragedy of George Floyd, although that was an immensely piercing tragedy. She was weeping because she said, "I've known this happened and I've never felt it before and I've never done anything about it." And so she catalyzed a group of, you know, white rural people who'd never demonstrated before, and they had a Black Lives Matter vigil. And so there are things like that, you know, there's a nascent willingness to come to terms with the need for reparations for what has been not the crimes of the past, but the crimes ongoing, economic, social, justice, everything you can think of, physical crimes against the black body.
I recall that when you were a foreign correspondent in the Middle East in the 80s and 90s, you were constrained as a woman in your job. Getting access to men was difficult. So you brilliantly decided to interview wives and the women of the region, which then gave you access to men's lives.
It gave me all kinds of insights. It was really, you know, those 6 years, I don't think, you know, they're the foundation of what I do now, because the amount of experience that I had in those years, I'm still, I guess, living on the fat of that in transforming it into the fictional lives that I now report. But yeah, it was actually knocking on an open door, because women were so ready to be heard and to tell their stories. And then, you know, once they knew me and once they trusted me, then they gave me an entree to some pretty extraordinary leaders of movements like Hezbollah and the family of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. And I just feel like I got a much deeper insight than I would have by, you know, sitting in some gilded salon doing a conventional newspaper interview when I was actually sharing the dirt floor in a refugee camp, or actually sitting in Khomeini's courtyard having a cup of tea with his widow.
Let's now talk briefly about your most recent book, The Secret Chord. I understand that it's in a sense a response to your eldest son, Nathaniel, who plays the harp.
Well, yes, he does. He plays the harp beautifully. And when he was preparing for his bar mitzvah, he decided that he would play an arrangement of Leonard Cohen's wonderful song, Hallelujah. And so we were, you know, going to shul more than we normally would have done while he was getting ready for his bar mitzvah. And I started to be curious about David from that half-line reference in the lyrics about Bathsheba. And I started looking him up in the scriptures, and I found story was so full and so rich, and it's almost like the first full biography of a man that we have. It's we meet him as a young child, and we follow him to his deathbed in old age, and in between, every single thing happens to him. the best and worst things that could happen to any human being. He's a great success on the battlefield. He's a political leader, but he has to go through a period of exile, and he's an outlaw, and he's a musician and he's a poet, but he's also an absolutely brutal and ruthless killer. His children turn on him, attempt to overthrow him. They turn on each other. There's fratricide. And yet it's all redeemed in the person of his young son, Solomon, who succeeds him as king and becomes a byword for wisdom and good governance.
Now, back in 2011, your Boyer lectures focused on the notion of home, home in Australia, home in America, home away from home. Where do you feel most comfortable today?
That's a very good question. You know, I would answer it differently right now than I normally would answer it, but because of Tony's sudden death, he's very present to me here in this home that we shared for the last decade, a very old house built in 1740, before the white history of Australia even began. And so for a while, I think, you know, I need to be near his our most recent memories and inhabit that. But if you had asked me before he died, I would definitely say, sitting on the balcony of my place in Balmain, which I'm very lucky to have and can't wait to get back to as soon as I don't have to go into jail in a hotel for 2 weeks.
Geraldine, thank you very much for your time. Geraldine Brooks, journalist, author, ABC Boyer lecturer, and the latest book, The Secret Chord, is published by Hachette. I look forward to seeing you back in Australia and not in prison. That's your lot, beloved listeners. Coming up from, we'll have the UK with Ian Dunt, and author Sarah Krasnostein will introduce us to believers of all kinds. See you then.